The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call coming to you on this 5th day of December 2011 from the nightly stupors of Singapore. Well, imagine if you walked into a bank, applied for a personal line of credit, and filled out all the paperwork claiming to have no debts and an income of $200,000 a year. The bank, based on these representations, extended you the line of credit that you were after. Then, 3 years later, after fighting disclosure all the way, you were forced by a court to tell the truth. At the time you made the statements to the bank, you were actually unemployed. You had a $1 million mortgage on your house on which you had failed to make payments for 6 months. And you hadn't even paid the minimum on your credit card bills for 3 months. Do you think the bank would just say, never mind, don't worry about it? Of course not. Whether or not you had paid back the personal line of credit, three FBI agents would be at your door within hours. Yet this is exactly what the major American banks have done to the public. During the deepest, darkest period of the financial cataclysm, the CEOs of major banks maintained in statements to the public, to the market at large, and to their own shareholders that the banks were in good financial shape, didn't want to take TARP funds, and that the regulatory framework governing the banking system should not be altered. Trust us, they said. Yet unknown to the public and the Congress, these same banks had been borrowing massive amounts from the government to remain afloat. The total numbers are staggering. $16 trillion in nearly interest-free money went to the too big to fail banks between 2007 and 2010. I bet you haven't been hearing about that on the nightly news. Ladies and gentlemen, these figures are not estimates. They come from the Limited General Accounting Office audit of the Federal Reserve mandated by the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Here is what's so absolutely and utterly fantastic about that. The report was made available to all, yes, all members of Congress, but they all remained silent about it, except Senator Bernie Sanders. Oh, and by the way, $3.08 trillion went to foreign banks in Europe and Asia. Why do they do this? Why do they give away your taxpayer money when one in four children in the United States lives in poverty? And now, of course, the too-big-to-fail banks are larger than ever. the total assets of the six largest banks increased by 39% between September the 30th, 2006 and September the 30th, 2011. Have you ever thought about how much interest these banks rake in from you again, the taxpayer? Basis money which was given to them by the Fed, which they conjured up out of thin air. All $16 trillion of it, ladies and gentlemen. $7.7 trillion of credit, that's one half of the GDP of the entire nation, of which $460 billion was lent to JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley alone. Remember, without anybody other than a few select officials of the Fed and the Treasury knowing, this was probably the single most massive allocation of capital from public to private hands in U.S. history. And nobody was told. This was not TARP. This was secret Fed lending. And although it has since been repaid, it is clear why the banks didn't want you to know about it. They didn't want to admit the magnitude of their financial distress. The banks' claims of financial stability and solvency appear at a minimum to have been misleading and may have been worse. Misleading statements and deception of this sort would ordinarily put a small market player or borrower on the wrong end of a criminal investigation. So why aren't these bank CEOs being prosecuted for making false statements? And what about someone finding out about why the Fed and Treasury officials stood by silently as bank representatives made claims that were false, misleading, or worse? Only now, because of the absolutely amazing, superb analysis done by Bloomberg reporters, who litigated against the Fed and the banks for years to get the information, are we getting a full picture of the Fed and Treasury lending? The reporters also calculated that recipient banks and other borrowers benefited by approximately $13 billion simply by taking advantage of what is called the spread between their cost of capital in these almost interest-free loans, and their ability to lend the capital. In addition to the secrecy, what is appalling is that these loans were made with no strings attached, no conditions, no negotiation to achieve any type of specific public purpose. Even if one accepts the notion that the stability of the financial system couldn't be sacrificed, those who dispensed trillions of dollars to private parties made no apparent effort to impose even minimal obligations to condition the loans on the structural reforms needed to prevent another crisis, made no effort to require that those responsible for creating the crisis be relieved of their jobs, took zero steps towards the genuine mortgage reform that is so necessary to begin a process of economic renewal. The dollars lent were simply a free bridge loan so that the banks could unload their own risk-taking onto others. If ever there was an event to justify the darkest, most conspiratorial view held by many that the alliance of big money on Wall Street and big government produces nothing but secret deals that profit insiders, this is it. So now that we know about all this, why aren't the authorities demanding a hearing where the bank executives have to answer questions under oath about the actual negotiations, or lack thereof, that led to these loans, about the actual condition of each of the borrowing banks, and whether that condition differed from the public statements made by the banks at the time? Why aren't the recipient banks being required to use this previously undisclosed gift, the profit they've made by investing this almost interest-free money, to write down the value of the mortgages of those who are underwater? The loans to the banks were meant to solve a short-term liquidity problem, not be a source of profits to fund bonuses. They should be being made to take back the profits and put them to a public use. Look, for the first 96 years of the Fed's existence, primary market activities were to buy or sell U.S. Treasury bonds and to lend at the discount window. Neither of these activities permitted the Fed to sort of play favorites, to pick and choose who they just felt like lending money to. But these programs are fundamentally different. They do indeed allow the Fed to play winner and loser. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you my information. Again, this is Richard Martin. It is the wake-up call, and it's coming to you from Singapore. And the toll-free number that I would be very happy for you to use to call in and make some comments about this kind of thing and lots of other kinds of things as well. Ask questions, make rants, do one thing or another, have discussions. The number, the toll-free number, is 888-874-4888. Once again, our toll-free number here is 888-874-4888. If you would like to email me with the same kind of questions and pieces of information one way or another, you may do that. The email address, which remains open at all times, is rm@gfawd.com. RM stands for Richard Martin, at GFAWD, which stands for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Once again, rm@gfawd.com. And if you'd like to call me in private to discuss financial affairs, economic and otherwise, you may call me on my direct line in Sarasota, Florida, at area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. Anytime, day or night, no difference, no problem. Leave a name and a phone number if I don't answer the phone, and I will call you back. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, we had a nice turnout at the meetup group yesterday, and many thanks to Susan, who is moderating it, and she's doing a fine job, and I hope you will all think about coming to the next meeting. I don't actually have the date right now, but as soon as I get it from Susan, I will let you know. It will be, of course, in January, and apparently the venue was an excellent choice, so I'm sure that the George Street Ale House will be welcoming our members back early next year. All right, well, following on from my comment on Friday about the current execrable Detention Act, I believe it's called, I'm sure you've all had a chance to learn more about it over the weekend. It's caused quite a stir, quite a scandal. As everyone realizes by now, the Congress's push for indefinite detention includes American citizens on American soil. And as Huffington Post notes, the debate also has left many Americans scratching their heads as to whether the Congress is actually attempting to authorize the indefinite detention of Americans by the military without charges. But proponents, led by Senators Lindsey Graham, Kelly Ayotte, and Carl Levin, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, say that is exactly what the war on terror requires. They argue that the bill simply codifies precedents set by the Supreme Court and removes uncertainty, which they said would better protect the country. As Empty Wheel and Glenn Greenwald note, the White House has believed for many years that it possessed the power to indefinitely detain Americans. The government can also kill American citizens. For more than a year and a half, the Obama administration has said it could target American citizens for assassination without any trial or due process. But now, as shown by the debates surrounding indefinite detention, the government is saying that America itself is a battlefield. The Associated Press noted over the weekend, U.S. citizens are legitimate military targets when they take up arms with Al-Qaeda, top national security lawyers in the Obama administration said Thursday. The government lawyers, CIA counsel Stephen Preston and Pentagon counsel Jeb Johnson, said U.S. citizens do not have immunity when they are at war with the United States. Johnson said only the executive branch, not the courts, is equipped to make military battlefield targeting decisions about who qualifies as an enemy. The courts in habeas cases, such as those involving whether a detainee should be released from the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba, make the determination of who can be considered an enemy combatant. You might assume, in a vacuum, that this might be okay. It trashes the Constitution, the separation of military and police actions, and the division between internal and external affairs. But it is dangerous in a climate where you can be labeled as or suspected of being a terrorist simply for questioning war, protesting anything, asking questions about pollution or about Wall Street shenanigans, supporting Ron Paul, being a libertarian, holding gold, or stocking up on more than 7 days of food. And see this, it is problematic in a period in which FBI agents and CIA intelligence officials, constitutional law expert Professor Jonathan Turley, Time Magazine, Keith Olbermann, and The Washington Post have all said that U.S. government officials, quote, were trying to create an atmosphere of fear in which the American people would give them more power, end of quote. And even former Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge admits that he was pressured to raise terror alerts to help Bush win re-election. And it is counterproductive in an age when the government, instead of doing the things which could actually make people safer, are doing things which increase the risk of terrorism. And it is insane in a time of perpetual war. And when the war on terror in the Middle East and North Africa, which is being used to justify the attack on Americans, was planned long before 9/11, and when Jimmy Carter's national security advisor told the Senate in 2007 that the war on terror is, quote, a mythical historical narrative, end of quote. And 9/11 was entirely foreseeable, but wasn't stopped. Indeed, no one in Washington even wants to hear how 9/11 happened, even though that is necessary to stop future terrorist attacks. And the military has bombed a bunch of oil-rich countries when it could have instead taken out bin Laden years ago. Look, ladies and gentlemen, let's face this directly here. The government's indefinite detention policy, stripped of its spin, is literally insane. And based on circular reasoning, stripped of PR, this is the actual policy. If you are an enemy combatant or a threat to national security, we will detain you indefinitely until the war is over. It is a perpetual war, which will never be over. Neither you or your lawyers have a right to see the evidence against you, nor to face your accusers. But trust us. We know you are an enemy combatant and a threat to national security. We may torture you and try to cover up the fact that you were tortured because you are an enemy combatant. And so basic rights of a prisoner guaranteed by the Geneva Convention don't apply to you. Since you admitted that you are a bad guy while trying to tell us whatever you think we want to hear to make the torture stop, it proves that we should hold you in indefinite detention. See how that works? And by the way, this bill is attached to a bill which authorizes the pumping of over $650 billion into wars and aggressive weaponry, continuing the war on Afghanistan, ramping up in the creation and use of drones, and the expansion of military bases all around the globe. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know about you, but I am now really scared. They mean business, these people. I don't know what their motive is. I don't know why they have taken leave of their senses in this way. But all of us are at risk here. And those people in the United States are at grave risk. I don't say tomorrow, I don't say next week or next month. But as far as I'm concerned, there is going to be a major, devastating war, and it will involve America and China, and neither side will win this thing. That many hundreds of millions of people will die. All right, well, let's talk about something else for a change. You know, it's amazing how history keeps repeating itself again and again. Yesterday, Douglas Holtz Eakin, former director of the Congressional Budget Office, was being interviewed on CNN. And here's what he said when asked about the U.S. economy. And it has two silver linings. Silver lining number one is that there's not much left to go wrong. Housing's already depressed. Auto sector's down. So you really can't get much more downside. So we need to grow. And manufacturing has turned out to be in much better shape than anyone dreamed. It's been the real engine of this recovery. End of quote. Not much left to go wrong? You know, I would laugh at this if it weren't so sickening. Let me quote, repeat this quote from John Kenneth Galbraith's 1954 book called The Great Crash, 1929, where he contrasted the 1929 with previous panics. And I quote, "A common feature of all these earlier troubles, or previous panics, was that having happened, they were over. The worst was reasonably recognizable as such. The singular feature of the Great Crash of 1929 was that the worst continued to worsen. What looked one day like the end proved on the next day to have been only the beginning. Nothing could have been more ingeniously designed to maximize the suffering, and also to ensure that as few as possible escaped the common misfortune." That's the end of quote from page 108. In fact, Douglas Holtz Eakin was directly contradicted by Carl Case, co-author of the Case-Shiller report. On Tuesday, when the latest Case-Shiller report was released, I found the following transcription from an interview with Carl Case of the BBC when Case explained why he thought housing prices would fall at least another 5 to 10% based on experiments he tried with his home price computer model quote, I quote, "We shocked our model with the shadow inventory. If we put in the entirety of the shadow inventory into our home price model, home prices would fall another 30%. While we don't expect that to happen, the shadow inventory would never make its way like a wave into the market. But what it does show is the market clearing price for homes. So we have a long way to go before we see anything like normalcy, or normality as I like to say, in the home market." End of quote. So when Holtz Eakin says that not much is left that can go wrong, he's not only dead wrong, he's catastrophically wrong by 30%. And in fact, during the financial panic, which is coming, that shadow inventory will indeed make its way like a wave into the market. Holtz Eakin is like all the economists you see on TV. He's using econometric models that have consistently been proven wrong. Being consistently wrong doesn't seem to bother Holtz Eakin or anyone else in Washington or on Wall Street, as long as they get their money. Okay. So we've got a few minutes left before we take our break, so why don't I, take an email here. I've just got one from Kevin Moran, who says, "Richard, Steve Leisman of CNBC just returned from Frankfurt and was reporting for CNBC this morning. He didn't seem at all optimistic about a euro solution. He cited the German opposition to the ECB buying debts, as was done with the US banks in 2008. He also reported that the German people are vehemently opposed to Germany financing the weaker euro countries, such as Italy. It doesn't seem as if Merkozy, that's a mixture of Merkel and Sarkozy, can propose and implement a plan to save the EU. It should be noted that Steve Leisman is a CNBC commentator who usually wears the rose-colored glasses, compared with the more critical commentator, Rick Santelli. Meanwhile, the market continues up strongly because the political leaders of France and Germany are meeting ahead of the larger European Union meeting later this week." Kevin Moran. All right. Well, you see, let's have a quick glimpse at the absurd statistics disgorged by the Labour Department about unemployment last Friday. In the last year, the civilian population rose by 1,726,000, yet the labour force fell by 67,000. Those not in the labour force rose by 1,793,000. In November, those so-called not in labour force rose by a whopping 487,000. If you're not in the labour force, you are counted as unemployed. Were it not for people dropping out of the labour force, the unemployment rate would be well over 11%. In the entire history of the labour force data, only in 1951, 1964, and 2009 did the labour force shrink. It also shrank in 2011 off 2010. Also note that from 1964 to 2007, only in 1991, at 631,000, 1995 at 723,000 and 2002 at 801,000 did the labour force fail to add more than a million people. However, in 2008, the labour force only expanded by 776,000. This was followed by a loss of 826,000 in 2009, a trivial gain of 155,000 in 2010, and a loss of 67,000 in 2011. Now, if you look at the average labor force growth from 1949 to 2007 of 1,579,000, the labor force should have expanded by 6,316,000 between 2008 and 2011. Instead, the labor force expanded by a mere 38,000. Thus, 6,278,000 people are unaccounted for in the unemployment numbers based on historical averages. So here's the unvarnished reality. The unemployment rate adjusted for population growth in 2007 was 4.7%. In 2008, 7.3%. 2009, 11.7%. 2010, 12.4%. And in 2011, 12.2%. Those who think the economy is improving based on the falling unemployment rate are looking at a statistical mirage based on an extremely atypical and prolonged drop in the labor force. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I don't expect you to remember all those figures. I guess I was just showing off in a way. I was giving you my knowledge of the very reason why I know for a fact that unemployment is rising vis-a-vis 2007, 2008, etc. So I'm not just spouting off a view here. These are statistics which are painfully accurately recorded and portrayed, largely through the efforts of the Labor Department. And so you can see for yourself that they can fool you, because very few people, and certainly not the mainstream media, is going to take the trouble to give you the figures that I've just given you. But once you've seen the figures for yourself, and once you've understood them, and hey, if you need to go back and listen to the archives and note them down for yourselves, you'll find that they make perfect sense. They prove out precisely. You need to do that. Because, let me tell you, you are being fooled yet again by the powers that be. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take our break, and I'll be right back. Okay, well, we are back. And let me very quickly take an email I just got in during the break from Michael Reidinger, who says this. Hello, Richard. I wanted to share a funny Bloomberg statistic that I saw this morning. It read, 43% of Americans unemployed haven't worked in the last 6 months. I would say that 100% of those unemployed didn't work in the last 6 months. Double speak, eh? Michael R. No, Michael, no, it's actually worse than you think. For example, let's imagine somebody was laid off a week ago. Have worked in the last 6 months. In fact, they worked up until last week. But really, the statistic that you bring up is very, very telling. Because what they're basically saying is that including the guy that was laid off last week, all of the people going back who are today unemployed, you take a snapshot of everybody unemployed, from the guy that was unemployed last Friday all the way back to the very first guy who was unemployed as far back as it goes. What they're saying is that 43% of all the unemployed people haven't worked in the last 6 months. That's a very frightening statistic. It's true, of course, but it really does point up the horror of the current depression. And while we're talking about depressions, you know, it wasn't until around 1939 that the so-called Great Depression was widely referenced as such. So it's quite interesting, and I mentioned this before, but you have to wonder when they will finally cop to the present one in the mainstream media. And frankly, the vast majority of people don't recognize severe instances of widespread and prolonged trauma until it's mostly over. It's very similar to how individuals fail to realize for a long time that they may be suffering from major depressive disorder. Even their families often don't usually recognize until it's too late and years along the path of progression. You know, the story about what may start like the proverbial butterfly in Africa that starts a Force 5 hurricane in America months later. It's like someone having a bad day or a bad year, maybe because of a major financial loss or death in the family, or maybe even nothing nearly as significant. Most often aren't diagnosed until after many years. Well, clearly the financial problems began well before 2008, when finally major intervention began in the U.S. in an attempt to contain some of the collateral damage. And obviously, even by then, the country was already in a massive depression. And the trouble, the proverbial butterfly, started well over 30 years ago. And even today, virtually none of the trillions in debt has been at all written off. In fact, they've mostly become significantly larger worldwide. And so now we're seeing constant band-aids being applied with the most obvious and recent coordinated central bank intervention. We won't know until several years from now how massive this one was, because it's far from being over. How many people at the time knew back in 2008 that the Fed had injected more than $16 trillion worldwide? How many people even know it today? Although after this weekend, a lot more did than before. The debt has multiplied several fold since 2008. Derivatives have continued to expand unabated since then, meaning leverage and exposure without capital. The Eurozone problem is a worldwide Lehman situation, many times more serious. 20 years from now, if we all live to see that day, we'll be looking back, scratching our heads, and asking how we failed to see this. Why did we continue to believe throughout the entire crisis that things were only going to get better? How did we fail to see that this recent worldwide central bank coordinated intervention was the beginning, not anywhere near the end of a major and prolonged economic collapse? Why did we think we could pile debt on top of debt and continue to do so? Debt on debt on top of liquidity and liquidity, debasing the currencies, and yet more debt. Was it because our only thermometer to determining the illness was a stock market that stayed levitated for so long? If the stock market is your only thermometer, your only gauge of financial so-called health, and you have no other instruments in your medical bag, like an EKG or a CT scan, it's pretty likely that you'll detect the pretty unlikely that you'll detect the canker until the patient is near death. Ladies and gentlemen, this depression is going to go on for a very long time, occasionally interrupted by temporary illusions of recovery and even bouts of so-called prosperity until these debts and derivatives are wiped out or written off. The debt and leverage has gone way past the point of no return. We've sucked at least 20 future years of economic prosperity into the past decade, maybe more, so that economic output or worldwide GDP has already been tapped. Let me put that another way. Every man, woman, and child could work for the next 20 years and be no better off than today, have no more savings, no more true wealth than they have today. It's actually worse than that, because those who don't have jobs are getting further than 20 years behind. So in all probability, those people will never even recover to the standard of living they had as little as 2, 3, 5, or even 10 years ago. All right, well, let me have a look. I think we might have... Oh, we have an email from Dana Cooper, who says, and Nat, you might want to comment on this in my instant messaging. Hi, Richard, your voice is breaking up. Not sure if you know that. Mike, if this is a Matt, if this is a problem, maybe I should call back, but let me I'll wait to hear from you on that score. Meanwhile, Dana, thank you very much for the information and the heads up on that. All right. Okay, well, Matt says if there was a problem, I would have told you, which I'm sure is true. Dana, I don't know what to do in your case. If it persists, maybe you could perhaps give somebody a ring and find out what they have to suggest, but the problem is you're on your end. But thanks anyway. If anybody else is having a problem, please do let me know. It's always useful. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you may know that home prices are sinking to new multi-year lows almost every month. And along with this, home ownership is falling to new lows as well. The implications of this are far-reaching. Consider, for one, the negative equity of job mobility. This used to be a huge competitive advantage the U.S. enjoyed, where people could move freely to advance their career, seek higher-paying jobs, and most importantly for employers, fill jobs with people who have the right skill sets. This is a key and often overlooked hurdle to improving the employment rate. Many, many jobs are going unfilled, or worse, being filled by people with less than ideal skill sets. The reason for this is that many of the talented people have negative equity on their 500,000, 650,000, and $700,000 homes. 20 to 30% negative equity. So you think people making enough to afford those kind of homes would move anyway and take the hit? Think again. Many of the new jobs not being filled are in the high-growth, high-tech space. Back when home prices were always going up, people were more than willing to take a new job, even if it meant some risk, because they could count on that good old home piggy bank as a fallback, if not cushion, if the job didn't work out for some reason or the company went belly up in 2 years. Not so much anymore. I know somebody whose husband was a highly paid consultant and specialized in expertise in software. He still got that job, but also has taken on the shepherding of an internet startup that got bought out. They had built new homes and moved several times in the early part of this decade, always making out on each move. This last time, though, they built at the peak and are now taking it in the shorts, big time. Her husband commutes from Illinois to Texas for 4 days a week. Now he wants to move the family down there. She can't move because their home is underwater and the unknown of the stability of this new position for the husband. He's going to be having the opportunity to run the company. Not assured, but it's yet another potential big step up. No dice. Mom rules, puts the foot down, and even if it costs them some income and her husband's advancement, she won't move. So here is this job that is going to be vacated soon, essentially because their current home is underwater, yet the company feels they have in this guy the perfect person. He's basically in the position but can't stay in it because it will crater the family. He's in terrible trouble because he can't be with his wife and three kids in this commute situation. So if he doesn't move up, then the person who would have filled his old role can't move up, and his company suffers from the dearth of his unique experience and skill sets. The family will accept him staying in his, albeit decent-paying, job in Illinois, but lower-paying and lower wealth-building and therefore lower spending in the economy. Now, I assure you, this is happening at all levels on the job scale throughout the economy. People aren't moving at any rate of turnover as they used to be. The United States was built on its mobility. This is one of the key points creating the American dream and the higher standard of living that Americans came to be used to. You know, you had the advantage of cars, of highways, of airports, planes, and so on. But hugely, Just as important was the forever increasing appreciation of the nation's housing stock. This was unique to America. The ease of transfer, the ease of deed ownership. Well, that element of appreciation is gone. That sure thing of most people's most important, if not largest, single asset has taken a tremendous hit. And it's not just a temporary hit. It's secular. And in people's minds, the psychological impact on security, weighing risks overall, confidence in oneself, skill sets, future prospects, has taken a major, major hit. Of course it affects spending on everything and lifestyle choices. If people in that so utterly crucial upper 20% stop being so mobile, that means every 20% strata on downward in the pool is affected. It's a game changer for employees and employers. Also, far fewer immigrants are now moving to the United States than just a few years ago because it's not such a sure thing. This type of hit to consumer confidence of their formerly most secure asset, their homestead, their anchor of stability, has now become one of their biggest liabilities in ways previously unfathomable. This appreciating asset has been for the foundation of the U.S. economy since the 1950s. It's not only down, but taking people, families, towns, and so on right down the toilet with its depreciation. And you know, something like this doesn't turn around on a dime. This is akin to a total shaken confidence in a currency. It's like the run on a bank. It's a run of the worst kind, though. Government backs a currency. The faith is by fiat or decree. Government isn't backing housing, though. They're backing banks. They're backing the Fannies and Freddies. They're backing and protecting the elites and the CEOs of those banks. But they're not doing one thing to protect each and every homeowner in America. They've in fact stripped Americans to the very core and robbed them blind. Americans are slowly waking up to this fact. But they have long ago been woken up on the fact that housing is no longer that sure bet, their anchor, their most precious asset beyond their children and families. That occurred after 2006, and it's been a new kind of dawning, or rather nightmare, for them for 5 years straight. And as forecasts go, will most assuredly be at least another 5 years hence, if not longer. They feel it in their bones. It's reflected in the economy and the sentiment polls and the confidence polls that stay at persistently dire levels. The numbers ebb and wane, but the direction is clear. It's still down. They know the hubris and excess has not been worked off. Only a fool would buy a new home now, or move to another unless they absolutely positively have to. The OWS and the Tea Party are just beginning to see the building frustration. The housing stock situation will no doubt have to get a lot worse before it gets better. ZIRP, or zero interest rate policy, and decades of low, dirt-cheap money only lengthen the pain and the depth that the entire country will have to endure. People in the upper echelons, if they get it, are doing it on purpose. They're prolonging the pain. We have to ask why. We need to demand better. Foreclosures are feeding upon foreclosures. More and more strategic defaults are occurring. People have to live somewhere, but they will refuse to be shackled to a sinking ship. the foreclosures are creating more foreclosures and decimating neighborhoods, towns, suburbs, local governments who rely on homes and taxes and then have to start shrinking themselves ever massively so. They can't plug the gaping leak holes in budgets and infrastructure that has been designed from the get-go on Ponzi exponential growth. Connect the dots. It's going to take more than just adapting as the resourceful Americans have been so many times in the past. This is secular or long-lasting. And the federal government is not only going to the catalyst, but they are in the way. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me take an email that comes from Sarita, who says, "Dear Richard, recently Gary has been speaking of the Senate Bill 1867. We were encouraged to write saying no to this. I am speechless as to the news you just gave of how the Senate introduced this horrific bill. Yes, I am sure it will become law. On the subject of being watched, I recently experienced something that made me feel strange right here in New York City. There is a bus line on 2nd Avenue which has introduced a new way of purchasing the ticket. You can pay the fare before boarding by inserting your Metro card and receiving a receipt. On a recent day, once I was seated, I was surprised to see several policemen going from person to person requesting to see the receipt. I remembered boarding the train in Italy with a prepaid ticket and no one coming to check. There is an honor system there that is respected. When I got off, I was further amazed that there were several policemen at each of the exit doors asking again for the receipt. For that particular stop, there were 5 guys waiting for that bus. There was one older gentleman who had bought his ticket right after me, so I knew he had it since he boarded. However, he was anxiously looking for it in all his pockets and couldn't find the little piece of paper. I felt very sorry for him because I saw he was perspiring and upset. He was asked to purchase another ticket so as to produce the receipt. It was an uncomfortable scene. Another day, I took a taxi during the daytime. I noticed that there was a 50-cent surcharge. This is what one sees for an evening ride. When I asked the driver, he explained that this is a new tax that our mayor has introduced. So the MTA adds this on, whether it's day or night. We began a conversation when I learned that he is of Swedish background and has been out of a job for 9 months and was going to be a taxi driver for only a few more weeks. He said he just couldn't stand all the taxes that are now imposed. He showed me that the $10 fare contained $2 of a tax called sales tax. He said that all the taxi cab drivers are most upset since they aren't selling anything and yet they had to agree to this sales tax. What was most unsettling was hearing him say that many of the foreign drivers have been saying they will join the revolution that has yet to come. He said that their anger is very real. He also talked of how all one hears is of how the very rich must be taxed, and no one talks of all the new taxes that people like him now have to pay. I am not the 1%, he said. This is so unfair. Just a bit of transportation news from the Big Apple. Regards, Sarita." Well, Sarita, thank you very much for that. That was certainly enlightening. Oh, well, Dana Cooper writes in again saying, "Well, I am in Bermuda, so maybe it's my connection here." Yeah, maybe, indeed, it may be. Thank you very much for enlightening us anyway, Dana. Well, the John J. Heldrich Center, that's Heldrich, I think, the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University has published an updated working paper called Categorizing the Unemployed by the Impact of the Recession, detailing the results of surveys conducted from August 2009 to August 2011 of American workers who lost a job during the height of the Great Recession. According to the report, most of those polled had seen little evidence of the recovery that Washington and Wall Street keep harping on about. Just 7% of the unemployed initially contacted at the Heinrich Center in the summer of 2009 have made it back to where they were before the recession. And just another 23% are on their way back. They have experienced a minor downward change in their quality of life that they believe will be temporary. Another third of those participating in the initial August 2009 survey can be thought of as downsized. Many here, 11%, have taken a minor quality of life hit and say their financial situation is poor, but believe that they will work their way out of it in time. Another 10% are in at least fair financial shape, but report a minor downward change in their lifestyle they believe will be permanent. The remaining 36% speak of cataclysmic effects of the Great Recession on them and their families. They comprise two groups, both of whom can be said to have been devastated. We consider 21% to be devastated because they are in poor financial shape and have suffered a major quality of life change, even if they believe it to be temporary. Also included in this group are respondents who report being in fair economic shape, but who have experienced a major decline in their lifestyle they expect to be permanent. Finally, there is a sizable 15% who appear to have been wrecked by the recession. They are at the bottom on all three measures. They are in poor financial shape, have suffered a major change in lifestyle, and believe this new state of affairs will be a permanent condition. I bet those folks just love hearing repeated assurances from Obama et al. That the economy is continuing to heal. Right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with that, I fear we have come to the end of another show. I've talked a lot about the unemployed today, and I'm afraid that many of you will be in that condition. But in the meantime, let's hope that you have a tolerable weekend ahead, and I will be back on Friday with another edition of the Wake Up Call. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye to you.